probably, of Rabbi Keller's article in the current Jewish Observer.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the same thing. That's from, I spent money actually, bought this magazine. Unbelievable. And I actually bought this magazine.
The Observer's been around for years.
Right.
I was at the Spectator. I remember
BYU,
we used to, somebody used to come around, pass it out.
So, as far as current affairs are concerned, there's this long article by Rabbi Keller, which you have. That's the last page which you're holding, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first page is blank.
It's from Chabad, isn't it?
No, Rabbi Keller is a Rosh Yeshiva, the Tel Ziv Yeshiva in Chicago. And this is an article attacking Chabad, more or less identical to what we were discussing in the last shiur. In fact, it's practically identical with what Dr. Berger was writing. But of course, Dr. Berger's name is not mentioned at all in Rabbi Keller's article, even though Dr. Berger was in close contact with Rabbi Keller during preparation on this article.
They don't hold the shame on them?
No, it's because Dr. Berger's a professor. You have to understand the psychology.
Trade.
To quote a professor is trade. So, therefore, you saw the negative statements they made about me because I'm a professor.
Even if he's a full professor?
even if he's a professor gamur.
You work at Hebrew University the same way. So.
Yeah, so the snide comments about me in the OU journal were...
Where's that?
Because,
where is that?
That's in this thing.
Oh, we didn't see it.
Ellen made some copies of.
Oh, very much. I didn't see that.
By the way, I wrote to the student coming out of an even eye. As I expect. So, but it's a flogging and dead horse. Okay. So that's so much for. You can at least say that we're pretty up to date in terms of the magazines.
Yours is
not quite. Here are materials that I Xeroxed for tonight. These are my materials. That's mildly legal because I think most of that material is not copyright. Okay. Let me just, to set the stage, remind you of what the Rambam says in the beginning of Perek Beis. Ikar ha-tzivui v'avodat kohavim, shelo la'avod echad mikol ha-bruin, to worship any created being. That's the main command. Lo malach, v'lo galgal, v'lo kolchav, v'lo echad mi'arba'ah yisodot, v'lo echad mikol hanivraim mehem. So one is simply not allowed to worship any created object, from quarks to elements. The afal pi, sha'oved yodea sha'ashem hu elokim, even if the man recognizes the existence of the Almighty, of the Supreme Being, והוא עובד הנברא הזה על דרך שעבד אנוש ואנשי דורו תפילה. And he is worshipping these created objects because it's his belief that by worshipping these creatures, he is in fact giving glory to God. הרי זה עובד כוכבים. Nevertheless, such an act of worship is considered idolatry. בעניין זה הוא שהזירה תורה עליו ואמרה ופן תישא עיניך השמיימה וראית את השמש וגומר אשר אילך השם הלוקח אותה לכל העמים. Perhaps you will lift up your eyes to the heavens, etc. כלומר, שמה תשוט בעין לבך, perhaps you will speculate, תראה שאלו הן המנהיגים את העולם, that these are the forces which drive the world, והם שחילק השם אותם לכל העולם להיות חיים והבים ואינם נפסדים כמנהגו של עולם. And these in fact are eternal objects as in the nature of things. ותאמר שראוי להשתחוות להם ולעבדם, and therefore it's fit to bow down to them and worship them. Money makes the world go round, so then perhaps you would have the illusion that one should worship money. ובעניין הזה, ציווה ואמר, הישמרו לכם, פן יפדה לבבכם. beware that your hearts not be seduced. Klonav shalotit uve hihu halev la'avod elu liyot siusur b'neichem uve nagoi. Do not worship any of these people to be an agent, or what's the best word for siusur? What's a good translation of this? Intermediary, I guess, is a theological term, but siusur has simply a broker. Don't worship any of these to act as a broker between you and God. All right? I think that's enough to direct reading from the Rambam, and now let's try to deal historically with some of the halachic issues that are raised by this, and then...
Is that why we don't appeal to the angels?
For example, we don't appeal to the angels. But what about appealing to dead people to appeal for us?
Why do people go
to the cemetery and pray?
Yeah, say they should better speak well.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
because that's
the way.
Is it a Litvashim minhag or is it a Hasidic minhag?
Well,
the disagreement over this point goes far back before the existence of either Litvax or Hasidim. So let's trace some of the issues here. And because I was in a really great rush to get this Xerox, I only got it done about 20 minutes ago, running out. I haven't numbered the pages, so we'll have to sort of read this handout consecutively, simply because it'll be hard to refer to pages. But I think it's arranged more or less chronologically, even if it's not necessarily arranged completely in the order of topics that I want to cover. So let's first see this machloket between the Litvaks and the Hasidim expressed in the Gemara. So here's a quote on my very first page from Masechet Ta'anit. Lama, it's about the fourth line from the bottom of this extract. Lama yotzim lebeit hakvarot. Why do people go out? In other words, part of the process, if the rains haven't come after a series of fasts, then the entire community goes to the cemetery as part of the prayer. Lama yotzim lebeit hakvarot, kligi ba rabbi levi bar chama rabbi chanina. There's a difference of opinion on this issue between Levi ben Chama and Rabbi Chanina. Chad amar, hare anu chashuvim lefanecha kemetim. We go to the cemetery in order for the people to diminish themselves, to say that we are abject in front of God as the dead. And the other opinion is that the reason that they go to the cemetery is to ask for an intercession by the dead on their behalf. This is not praying to the dead, chas v'shalom, as we will see later, but this is somehow asking for the dead people to intercede on their behalf. My beinayu, what's the difference between these two opinions? Ike beinayu kim beinachrin. If it's a matter of simply saying that we're like dead, then you can go to Mount Auburn Cemetery, or the cemetery down the block here in Brookline. You don't have to go to a Jewish cemetery. But if the reason is that you're going to ask the dead to intercede on your behalf, presumably you're going to, the goyim are not going to be so kindly as to intercede on your behalf. So that's the Gemara. That's one quote in the Gemara. All right. Now let's go to two other quotes in the Gemara. Also, that was from the Masechta Ta'anit. Rabbi Mani Borei Havik Hametzar Le Debein Asiya. The house of the Nasi was Mitzari, was torturing or causing pain to Rav Mani. Ishtach al kibra da abua, he went and prostrated himself on the grave of his father. Amar le abba abba, hanu mitzayir. Daddy, daddy, these guys are troubling me, and therefore do something, and something happened. Okay, next quotation. From the Sechet Sota. Amar Rava. Melamed Shepiresh Kalev Miatzat Maraglim, that in the story of Kalev and Yehoshua, the two dissenting spies, Benishtateach El Kivrei Avot, and prostrated himself at the Marat HaMachtela, Amar Lehem Avotai, Bikshu Alar Rachamim She'inatzeel Miatzat Maraglim. Ask mercy that I may be saved from the plot of the Maraglim. Okay? Shene'emar, okay, etc. Alright? So, we have three places in the Gemara where the notion of asking a dead person to intercede on your behalf is mentioned. Now, let's see how the Rambam brings these various halachot. Sheva ta'aniyota elu. This is how the Rambam brings the Gemara in Tanya. Sheva ta'aniyota elu, kol makom shegzozvin otam sham, achar shem mitpalalim, yotz'im kol ha'am lebeit ha'kvarot. The entire community goes out to the cemetery, u'bochim u'mitkanenin sham, and cry and plead there, kolmar ha'rei atem meitim ke'elu im lo tashuvu midarkachem. So he gives a little twist on the Gemara. The Gemara seems to be saying that they're pleading to God, saying that we are dead if we don't get some rain, but the Rambam's interpretation is that the preacher says to the community that if you don't reform your ways, you will be just as dead as these dead people in the cemetery. Okay?
Probably a historical interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And in Hilchot Avel, the Rambam says, "Umetzayinim," the second line from the bottom, "et kol beit akvarot uronim netesh al hakever." We mark every grave and put a sign, a structure, which indicates the grave on every grave. But tzadikim. Ein bonim lahem nefesh al kivotehem, but there is no need, or one doesn't put such a structure over the grave of a tzaddik, shedivrehem heim zichona, that their words are their memory. V'lo yifaneh adam levaker akbarot. A man shouldn't take the time or the trouble to visit the graves. Attitude. The words are slightly mysterious, and of course this gave rise to much dispute in the later literature, which we'll see some of it, but straightforwardly the Rambam doesn't believe in visiting the cemetery. And he's against putting any markers which would even remotely lead to the notion of prayer via the intermediary of a dead person. Okay. And
much less fact.
Much less fact. Now, you have to remember that this is consistent with the Rambam's general theory about what happens to us after we die. According to the Rambam, there's no individual immortality of the soul. The best model is that, which is basically the position of Ibn Bajjah, which I think is, sounds reasonable to me, but it's not a current belief, namely that there's this central computer, which is called the active intellect. And each of us individually is just a terminal that's hooked into this central computer, and therefore, whenever there's information gathered via the terminal, it's fed into the central computer, but once the terminal breaks down, the only thing that remains is the information that's stored in the central computer. I guess this is as close as an analogy to Ibn Battuta's theory in modern terms. As I wrote in an article in the, where was it? That was in the Mathematical Intelligence, this is publish or perish, carried to the furthest extreme. The only thing that remains of us after our demise is the theorems that we prove in our lifetime. Nothing other than the theorems that we discover has any lasting existence. It's not a question of value. So therefore, according to this particular theory, it makes no sense to even ask a individual who's already dead to intercede on your behalf, because he doesn't exist anymore in any sense. In cybersecurity, it's only the theorems that he proved that exist in cybersecurity.
Those can't pray for anything.
And those can't pray for anything. Okay? I xeroxed you, say, the Rambam in Hilchot Teshuvah Parakhet on the next page, which where Halacha Bet and Halacha Gimel are pretty clear in putting this. The writer, of course, who's the small type, is outraged by this position. Halacha Gimel says, Kol ha-netesh ha-umra be-inyan zeh einah ha-neshama ha-tzricha l'guf. The notion of netesh that's being discussed here is not the soul which is needed for the existence of the body, ela tzurat ha-netesh. It is just the form of the soul. This is the knowledge which the individual soul has managed to achieve from the Creator. And is able to acquire the abstract knowledge, etc. So this is the straightforward Aristotelian position, and we might as well see how the Rambam sort of slips this idea into the Moral and Bukhin in his typical fashion.
Are these source, these cycles?
No.
So what's that?
That's Platonic. This is Aristotle. The notion of recycling or incarnation of what you have is an entirely different tradition.
So there are fixed number of souls that were created initially, and there's an infinite supply of them?
Well, let me answer you by quoting from the Rambam. This is I'm using Professor Penis's translation, and this is chapter 1, paragraph 74, the seventh method. The word's pretty good here. One of the creationists, again we're pretty current, one of the creationists maintains that creation of the world, I wasn't able to Xerox this. One of the creationists maintains that the creation of the world and time is established by what the philosophers say regarding the permanent existence of souls. He says, if the world is eternal, the number who died in the limitless past is infinite. There would therefore be an infinite number of souls existing simultaneously. Now this is a thing of which it has been indubitably demonstrated that is false. I mean the simultaneous existence of an infinite number of numerable things. Now, this is a wondrous method.
What does that mean?
You can't have a simultaneous existence of an infinite number of distinct objects. He was a finitist when it, Brouwer. He doesn't believe in the existence of formal set theory or anything of this nature.
This is much worse than formal set theory. He doesn't believe in the existence of the image.
Right, he doesn't believe in the existence of the image. In actuality, in principle, yes. Okay. Now, this is a wondrous method, for it makes clear a hidden matter by something even more hidden. That is, it's trying to prove the finiteness of the existence of the time of the existence of the world, which is a hidden matter, by something which is even more hidden, namely the non-existence of an infinite number of souls. So this, the proverb is well known amongst the Syrians. Well known amongst the Syrians, may truth will be applied, your guarantee needs another guarantee. It is as if he already possessed the demonstration of the permanence of souls, and as if he knew in what form they last, and what thing it is that lasts, so that he could make use thereof for drawing inferences. Now, if his intention was to force doubt upon the adversary who believes in the eternity of the world, and at the same time in the permanence of the souls, This consequence would follow necessarily if the adversary would contend to him would try to arouse the doubt of the imaginings that the individual entertain about his with speech concerning the contained existence of the soul's well-founded. Now, some of the later philosophers have resolved this doubt by saying that the souls endowed with continued existence were not bodies, so they would have place and position, and with regard to their existence, infinity in number would be impossible for them. Now, you know that regarding these things separate from matter, I mean these things that are neither bodies nor forces in bodies, but intellects, there can be no thought of multiplicity of any mode whatever, except that some of them are causes of the existence of others. In other words, you can have implications among spherums, but you can't have anything more than that. And thus, there is a difference amongst them because one is the cause and then the effect. However, what remains of Zaid is neither the cause nor the effect of what remains of Umar. Consequently, all are one in number, as Abu Bakr ibn al-Sa'i and others who are drawn into speaking of these obscure matters have made clear.
What is Zaid?
That's Ibn Batcha. That there's no such thing as a permanent existence of individual souls after death. I mean, you have to get to this particular chapter, which is on page 221. This is part 1, chapter 74, Elamar and Elohim. Let me just read to you what Shina says in his introduction about the relationship between the Rambam and Ibn Bajjah. As may be seen from the limited in Tibbon, Maimonides' attitude towards Ibn Bajjah is not marked by the reticence that he shows towards Avicenna. This is understandable. Ibn Bajjah died in 1138, was the founder of the Spanish school of Aristotelian philosophy, to which Maimonides belonged and which derived from Al-Farabi rather than from Avicenna. And he could not be, or at least was not, accused of teaching a doctrinally too lax and flying philosophy. He was, however, by no means a mere disciple, but an innovator full of ideas that heterodox, if they were considered from the point of view of Aristotle, or for that matter, of Al-Farabi. He was often criticized on this account by the faithful Aristotelian Averroes, who nevertheless respected him, as did Maimonides. In rejecting Avicenna's view concerning the disembodied soul, Maimonides makes one of his few explicit references to Ibn Bajjah. He credits this philosopher quite correctly, having made clear that as far as only the pure intellect is concerned, there are no individual differences. In other words, Aristotle qua intellect is identical with the other happy ones, in quotation marks. There are not a multiplicity of beings, but one. The intellect being regarded as the only portion of man that survives bodily death. This doctrine of Ibn Bajjah means that, contrary to Avicenna, nothing individual remains after death. As already been stated, Maimonides seems to incline to this opinion of Ibn Bajjah, yet he doesn't wholly commit himself to this, these being, according to him, hidden matters, etc. So he's careful to cover his back when he says these things, but I think it's pretty clear that what he says on this issue is. Okay, so certainly for the Rambam, the notion of asking dead people to intercede for you makes no sense whatsoever because they have no individual existence. Now, this particular dispute within Judaism exploded into a major dispute in Islam. And then from Islam, via partially Christianity, back into Judaism again. So we should now see the Islamic version of this. We'll turn to my next page. Because all of this is tied up with these issues of mysticism and rationalism and everything else. Topics which we've not really covered in Mr. Weinstein, I think you're the oldest member. I don't think we ever discussed these kinds of topics since 1959. Okay. All right. This is from one of the standard fat books on the subject, Illustrated History of the World's Religion. Parander is the author.
Here's one.
No. But all right, I'll come to that. I thought I brought it down, but if not, I will look for it upstairs. Okay. All right. Islamic mysticism called Sufism or Tasawuf was probably for the Arabic word for wool. The name comes from the earliest mystics' practice of wearing tough, rough robes of white wool, symbolizing both their rejection of the world and their special piety. It's sometimes argued that Sufism is a foreign import into the Islamic religious system, being the result of Muslim contacts with Christian hermits and holy men or with mystical forms of Greek thought. It is unnecessary, however, to turn outside into outside influence to explain the strong Muslim tendency towards mysticism, when it's only to read the Quran or to contemplate the life of Muhammad and his companions to recognize that all of the materials and stimuli for a more profound and immediate experience of the divine are present there. Numerous verses in the Quran assure the believer of God's nearness, of his ubiquitousness, and of his initiative in seeking men. Other verses urge men to draw nigh to God, to love him, and to remember him always. The Quran also recounts Muhammad's night journey to the divine, a presence where he communed with God face to face. This incident has been an inexhaustible resource for Sufi speculation, leading to a piety focused on the imitation of the Prophet who has shown the way to the vision of God's face. The asceticism of the Sufis is also prefigured in the humble and austere life of Muhammad and his immediate successors. Except for the asceticism, I want you to bear in mind the similarities between this and the Hasidic revolution that was taking place at the end of the 18th century. The objective of Sufism, as of all mysticism, is to attain union with God. Mysticism seeks for an immediate experience of the divine reality through the suppression of the ego. The method for attaining this most coveted experience, however, demands insight into special and hidden branches of knowledge. Sufi doctrine teaches that, besides the usual rules for religious life set out in the revelation and the Prophetic Sunnah, there's another and deeper level of spiritual meaning which the Prophet shared with only a few of his chosen companions. The revelation, thus, wears two faces, one open and obvious, and the other only to be seen by those who've been instructed in its secret. So, again, you should remember the Chabad, which Shneur Zalman means, a distinction between the tzaddik and the beinoni, which is it's only the tzaddik who really is capable of having true communion with God, whereas the ordinary folks like us sitting around this table can, with the pinch of our efforts, get almost as close to the lowest level of the tzaddik, but not quite. The relation between the exoteric and esoteric levels of religious knowledge is symbolic, with every command or rule of Sharia pointing to a higher truth that marks one of the stages of patience on the path to God. Very Kabbalistic, the existence of the inner secret meaning of the mitzvot as expounded in our own Kabbalistic doctrine. Knowledge of the Tariqah has been passed down from the Prophet through an unbroken chain, silsilah, I guess the same as the Hebrew word, of saints, walis, each of whom has chosen his successor and instructed him in the secret knowledge of the way to union with God. For the ordinary person, there is no access to the blessing of immediate divine communion except by association with a saint. Again, this is the philosophy of the tzaddik in Hasidism. And a complete submission to a discipline of asceticism, meditation, and spiritual growth as his preceptor may dictate. Sufis believe that there's always in existence a hierarchy of saints at work in the world, culminating in a principal spiritual power called the Kuf, the pole or pivot of the universe. These saints are continuing means for mediating the divine truth in the universe, the windows through which pours the divine light that invests all things with reality. Without the saints, the universe literally could not exist and would be bereft of order and reality. The doctrine of the saints is thus a cosmology and a metaphysics, as well as a pillar of personal mystical piety. Again, I urge you to compare this with a standard Chabad position. Okay? I think I don't have to read that next page aloud. It is the custom among simple people to make visits to the tombs of saints, to take them offerings, to make petitions, and to offer what amounts almost to worship, all in the belief that the saint's power can cure illness or aid in other difficulties of life. Such a cult of the saints can readily be generated from mere superstition, and modern reformers for this reason have opposed it vigorously. The modern reformers being, of course, the, what is it, the Wahhabi, how do you pronounce that? Wahhabi sect, which is currently in control in Saudi Arabia and various associated places, and of course they went and destroyed, in fact, the tombs of the saints. And it's important to remember that the fact that they represent the Wahhabis represent a Puritanism and a return to the purer form of religion doesn't necessarily mean that they're open to modernity in any way. These two things are poles apart. I mean, one of the additional main themes of the Wahhabi movement is to reject science or modernity in any form, just as much as it is a mistake to believe that the position of the Misnagdim at the beginning of the 19th century, as represented by the Gra, for example, had anything to do with being open to modernity and science or the Haskalah. I mean, repeat them. The various Maskilim who claim the Gra as a grandfather of their movement are just as mistaken as the Hasidim on this point. It is true that the existence of the Vilna Gaon probably had a major impact on the development of a Haskalah movement, but it was a sociological one rather than an ideological one. Namely, it turned Vilna into the magnet for the major intellectual center for Judaism in the first half and then also in the second half of the 19th century, and just having a whole huge number of extremely intelligent young men in the central yeshivot in Vilna and elsewhere gave rise to the possibility of ferment and the intrusion of modernity and Haskalah and what have you. But it's a sociological consequence, not a ideological consequence, as Rabbi Nadler makes very, very clear in his excellent new book. Have you all seen it? Let me see if I can find a copy. I'm looking for that other book that I really want. So,
and signed himself on the cover and started.
Okay. Here's a on my third page. There's a short quote from the Jewish Encyclopedia on Sufism, Judaica, Encyclopedia Judaica, in which important to see how much of a major influence Sufism had on Jewish intellectual thought, for example, on Bachya ben Pekuda and Mechavat al-Vavot, and especially on Rabbi Avraham ben Haramba, in adopting various Sufi practices. Again, since it's in English, you can read it without my having to read it aloud to you. Okay.
Where did this dialogue take place in Spain? Where they influenced each other?
It's hard to know. In Spain and in Egypt. I mean, we're talking about really quite different places. And there was a major cross current of influence here. And I'm not particularly equipped to. Maybe Tzvi can give you more information on the nature of this transmission than I can. All right. As I said, I've arranged the materials here more or less chronologically, but not topically, simply because I was going to add Russia. I've got the stuff you liked about a half an hour ago. Half an hour before it's yours. So I want to skip the Truma Sadeshin for the moment, deal with the technical question of the bowing. And let's read the next two Chubot of the Radbaz. Okay, so do we all have that? Okay. So it's two pages after that quote. Yeah. Exactly. No, I think it's the shorter one.
It is the shorter one.
Yeah, that's the one. Okay? No?
Yeah. This one.
There we go. Ul'inyan hadoresh asher doras lechlid sakin machshavto Ve'hamik zmamo el inyan avon ha'egel. The preacher who, the pun in Hebrew can is untranslatable into English.
Sharpened his mind.
Well, no. Darasa echlir atur the things which make a shchita invalid. And he's just taking a play on words, making the animal a trefa by giving this drush. V'chipes al Yisrael dvarim asher lo kein. And he accused the Bnei Avodah HaMidbar of things which were not so. They had mis al dor HaMidbar asher lo ala al libam. V'hu yitbarach katzaf ma'at v'adoresh hazeh azar lo ra'ah. Ra alai ha-ma'aseh. This is a bad business. Ve'eim en achem. There's no consolation for it. Lo alav ani mitzvahein. Ela gam ha-la-rishanim kmo barach tzeta emunah ha-rabenu Aaron ibn Rebbe. I don't know who these authors are. V'zulatam. She-katvu b'zah in yen davar ha-shalokim. Ayein v'divrehem she-ein ani rotzeh la-hatikan. I don't want to even copy them down. Ken e'anash chas v'shalom. Just merely copying their statements. That's how I feel about Xerox and some of this Lubavitch material, which I refuse to do except, you know, for myself and for the limited as necessary. Okay? ואם כל רוע דבריהם לא הגיעו לסברה הרעה והחלושה ומזויפת כסברת זה הדורש. They didn't reach the disgusting idea that this particular preacher had, namely accusing the Dor, the Chet of the Egel, or the Dor HaMidbar, of believing in some way that Moses was divine. Whatever the Chet of the Egel was, it didn't degenerate to such an extent to believe in the divinity of Moses. Okay? ואני רוצה להתנהג עם אוכל השני, מתנהג עם הקראים הקוקרים בדברי רזל. I want to deal with him the way I have to deal with the Karaites who deny of the rabbinical tradition. This anonymous preacher who dared to accuse the Dor HaMidbar, that portion of the Dor HaMidbar, dared to accuse them of the obvious of the sin of thinking that Moses was partially divine. Imputing some degree of divinity to Moses was such a degenerate thing that even though these people were guilty of a grievous sin, namely the chet of the ego, nevertheless they were not that sinful. Right?
They would accept an idol, but not a divine, not a real person, not a person.
According to the Ramban's interpretation that we studied the last time, they accepted the bull as a symbol for Moses, but not for the divinity. Remember, the bull itself, the Apis bull itself in the Egyptian culture, is a symbol for Osiris. That is, it doesn't represent itself as being a god, but as being a symbol for the dead god who goes underworld. So the notion of building a bull or a calf for a missing person was part of the Egyptian culture. But what he was saying is that no matter how degenerate this was and no matter how much of a crime it was, you couldn't possibly accuse them of believing that Chas v'Shalom Moses was in any way or part divine. Okay? That nobody was that degenerate. I quote that because I now want to quote from what is distributed. Again, I feel exactly like the Radvaz. Here is a piece of trash which is distributed from the Emunah Shleima, it is called, and put out by in Jerusalem as of last year, with quotations, I don't know if they're accurate or not, from Rabbi Schneerson. So I don't know if I'm saying Lashon Hara by simply repeating what they say in his name, or whether it is true. He says, here are the two quotes, and I'm just reading them to you verbatim. Yesh makshim, ma shayach bechlal lebakesh meharedi. Why is it possible to pray, to petition the Rebbe? Harei zuhi avodah zara shel mamutza. This is the avera of praying to an intermediary. Okay? If you're not allowed to pray to an intermediary, as the Rambam said, if that's avodah zara, then why are you allowed to pray to the Rebbe?
To petition.
Even to petition. Now what's the answer? The answer is ma'ane'al. Kishem she Yisrael oraita o kudsha brichu kulub chad. Hainu lo rak she Yisrael mitkashrim bi oraita bi oraita bakarish baruch hu. Ela chad mamash. Ach gam hait kashrut bein chasidim lebed. She eina kishnei dvarim hamidachtim. Ela naasim kulo chad mamash. Baharebi eino mumutsa matzik. He is not an intermediary that separates. Ki im mumutsa machaber, but an intermediary who joins. Lo ro'iti she yomer kach b'feirush b'tarat ha-chasidut, elo zehu hergesh. This is my feeling. Even though I haven't seen it. And I'll listen to this. U'bemele, mi she rotze yergesh u'miyeshen, u'telo, ani rotze l'tvachecho, yesh elo. U'mimele, ein makom l'kushya ogot mumutsa. There is no room for a problem about an intermediary. Miachar shezelu atzmut u'mahut Hakadosh Baruch Hu bi'atzmo kefi shehem mid atzmo b'guf. The Rebbe is the being and essence of God as he put himself in a body. And then they take the trouble to translate the slightly exact Yiddish. Vi erhat zecha reingestellt. Now, of course, he may have been saying this about his father-in-law, but his intention clearly was about himself.
It's pretty wild stuff.
Well, all right. Or he writes, again.
Who's writing this?
This is something that purports to be a direct quote from Rabbi Schneerson.
The direct quote from Sicha.
Yeah. The Natati Esev Besadchad of Hemtecha. Brichel Akon, he quotes a Zohar, saying that the Kudsha Brichel Bishinchei Medaber Al Tumoy. In other words, it's when Moshe Rabbeinu says the Natati Esev Besadchad, means that he, Moses, is going to put the wheat in the grass in the field. In other words, and of course, since Moses is an Ish Elokim, identical with God, then of course Rabbi Schneerson is also the current representative of being so. This, it seems to me, is absolute avodah zarah. What the Radvaz said that a preacher who even dreamt of accusing the Dor HaMidbar having such a belief in the divinity of the human being is here explicitly represented as a theology by this movement. Now,
we study Kabbalah with the Rambam.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, it seems to me that I feel exactly about that as Radvaz says that he felt about copying that material. It seems to me that it's absolute clear about his own.
Where does it leave the Masnagma? No relationship at all with the Rebbe at all. They had no relationship with the staff of them. They're out of the picture.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or they go out of
all right. Oh yeah. It's a tragedy. I'm not here to this whole business is a really a tragic development.
I was disheartened when I about last week. I felt better when I spoke to someone who said that there's an argument between the father-in-laws are not speaking to sons-in-laws. And I asked which are more likely to believe this? Because the younger ones are
yes.
more likely to believe
it. So that should make you less heartened.
Right? Well,
I mean, it's very depressing. I mean, it's a situation, and I don't know where this is going to end up. This is obviously over the line in any reasonable sense of the word. I mean, we have Hasidim and Misnagdim sitting around this table, but I don't think that anyone could have dreamt that the situation could have gotten this far out of hand. And I don't know what the future will bring. I suspect that it's going to be very long and complicated. And the position of Rabbi Keller is more or less the same identical things to what we've been saying around this table, maybe even citing some even more extreme examples, namely how the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt and so on, will represent, I guess, the position of the Aguda now. And Shmuel circulated the statement by the emissaries of Lubavitch who have decried this messianism and deism, or whatever you want to call it, what's up. All right, so this is sort of, I think, a pathological development within the last, I don't know how many years. The question is, how much is this the result of the